that said, there's a whole tier of managers that are very conventional, straight up the fairway. And they have typically a struggle raising capital within a compressed period of time. And those folks will give you first deal, first close discounts, and they will negotiate fee breaks based on size. They're just not as compelling in the lab as some of the other managers that don't have to do those things. And so you almost have to pick what you want to play to some degree. And the markets will change. There will be a period when it's no longer quite as robust from a fundraising perspective, and you will have that leverage when that marketplace returns. But right now, we're at a flash home. There are just a lot of money globally all trying to chase returns, and most of them are fee insensitive.
And there's some progress that we're not going to get back, just to be clear. Fee splits, monitoring fee splits and stuff like that, that's not going to move against us. So I think that's a permanent upgrade that's made through the last cycle. And there is much, much more transparency on this issue. So I think where we can fight is to continue to push down the transparency route. Because when people know that you're watching, it sort of controls some of their behavior. So this environment will definitely major on that.
This is an interesting point. I hope we can continue to iterate on it, because I see two competing duties here that are going head-to-head, and it's not clear what side of the line we're on. But I do hear that at the strategic and policy level that we need to be dynamic. And this is an important asset class. The juice is important for long-term returns. So I think it's pretty clear to us that more conversation on how we can meet the market, we need to have it.
Okay. It seems like the overriding objective, though, ought to be to yield the highest net returns. And you kind of have the fee issue on one hand as dampening that, but then you also have the selection, which your selection bias is to try and get into those top quartile funds.
Right.
And it seems like the top quartile fund, I think, will mostly swamp the fee issue or the other terms issues.
Well, the other part of this is that there's been such a big effort put into finding the right consultants and hiring the right staff and building a program that's successful, and I'm just looking at them. I'm really happy that they're here and really happy to have this team. So it sounds like the next phase in shoring up strength in this program is at the board level, in the other direction. Yeah. So, gone from.
Well, we will come back to you.
Can I ask another question? Maybe I'm just poking the line here a little bit, but if there's more sovereign wealth money coming in, and they operate in a very shadowy environment, they don't have to have meetings in public, they don't have other constituencies whose interests have to be met. Where do public pensions fit into the future of private equity? Are we going to get crowded out by sovereign wealth money?
Well, I think there's a couple.
Because they're easy clients, right? I mean, they go off, they meet in Milan.
They're notoriously, they have their moments, and then they don't.
Yeah.
Come in and out of the market fast. They're very unreliable. This is their track record. The bigger competition, long-term, as we think about our biggest managers, our biggest relationships, what they ultimately want to do is get their money from the public, to the small investor, the 401k. That's what we're doing more long term. But I think it brings up an interesting point, one that I wanted to make, just about our not public pension plans positioning, but our positioning within the broader limited partner ecosystem. And as already been referenced, by virtue of the large allocation of the asset class, we have been for decades one of the largest limited partners in the world. The quantum of capital we need to put to work every to maintain that allocation is on par with the large Canadian plans, the sovereign wealth funds, and much bigger pension funds than ourselves. The thing I think we're all recognized is within that large tier of LPs, we are a bit of an outlier with respect to how we implement our exposure. So we have continued to go down a path where we get most of our exposure to the primary fund, and then it's regular LP negotiation type thing is straightforward. Our competition, or our peers, I should say, we're not always competing, they have increasingly added co-investments, secondaries, and largely direct investing as part of their implementation mix. And I'm not raising this to suggest that we should go look like them. I think there's, you know, different is not fundamentally better. And there is a variety of reasons why we don't want to look like them and we can't look like them. I'm raising it because increasingly they're making demands of RGPs that make sense in the context of everything else they're doing. So they'll have more concentrated GP rosters than us. They'll do big global separate account relationships. But that's because what they really want to do overall is drive co-invest flow, see secondaries, co-sponsor transactions. To the extent they have a big leverage finance in-house team, they will finance transactions for the GPs. They'll try and be at the front of the line for allocations when portfolio companies go public. That's the potpourri of things that they're talking to the GPs about. And I think over time, the product that the GPs offer will be reflective of that. So we will get a slightly different product than we used to without getting some of the benefits. And again, I'm not in any way proposing that we replicate what our friends in Toronto and Singapore have created. What I'm saying is this is a 10-year, 20-year question.
Yeah, you're actually suggesting it's a symbiotic relationship, which is kind of interesting.
Well, they're getting much more holistic, close relationships with their GPs because of all this ancillary stuff that they're doing. I think, but much like the terms discussion, this is one that's going on in the background. I don't have a concrete idea of where this is going, candidly, which I did, but I don't. And it's something we need to come back to and talk about and think about what is the right solution for us, given our needs and our limitations in this context. But I just wanted to highlight that over the long run, this is a challenge.
But in the near term, Mike, that's another argument for flexibility for us.
I think so. Yeah. I think you're right.
Thanks, Mike.
Just one quick question on the data. And on the Torrey Cove, on your slide 3, I guess this slide, you know, it looks different to me than slide 5 in that slide 3 sort of suggests that our OPERF IRR, you know, while it outperforms Cambridge, right, if you look at it and eyeball it against some of the Russell benchmarked, it doesn't look that huge. Is it just the 300 bips that you guys added to it? Is that the essential difference between that and why it looks like there's such a great outperformance on slide 5?
So we do add 300 basis points to it on slide 3, and that's, you know, the majority of the delta there. But there is generally over the last 7 years, you know, absolute underperformance, even if you take that out, right?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
It's the long-term compound. If you started this math 7 years ago.
Depending at what point in time you're starting that calculation is what drives it. The graph on page 5 is, I would say, more illustrative in nature. You know, we're taking the actual market value, the cash flows in and out of the private equity program, putting them into the Russell, but doing it on a quarterly basis since inception, so there are some timing distortions there. So it's definitely an illustrative exhibit versus a 100% accurate representation of value creation. I think the order of magnitude is what we're trying to represent, and I think that's been demonstrated and holds up very well in time since inception. But if you were to do this calculation starting at different inception points, it looks very different.
And I would say private equity tends to underperform in bull markets, and you know, through most of 2015, we were on the tail end of a fairly, you know, since 2008, a very significant recovery in the bull market. The other, on slide 5, it tends to get distorted in periods where there's significant distribution as well, where money is coming back faster than what you're putting out. Mm-hmm. And so that is reflected in slide 5.2, which is the rate of distribution was so strong over the last several years.
And there's two, Mike mentioned this earlier, there's sort of two factors at play. There's the robust post-financial crisis in public markets, but the pre-financial crisis drag of 05, 06, 07 vintage years that still represent a very large portion of the market value of the portfolio that's...
So you don't see this at all an indictment of the public, you know, markets have as good or better return than the private. You still believe that the
absolutely
there's persistence in the private markets returns over public.
And there's a good slide where it talks about realized and unrealized investments. If you look at the IRRs of your exited investments, order of magnitude 17%. If you look at the stuff that hasn't been sold, it's roughly 12%. And so there is a fair amount of value creation that occurs. And most of your portfolio at this point is in privately held assets, not. And so that tends to get lost in sort of the calculation.
So I'm sensitive to time, so maybe get some highlights, and then you all can take us where you want.
Having said that, let me ask you a quick question. Seems to show that there's a fair amount of correlation between the public and private markets.
Well, there's a artificially inflated correlation here because the same cash flows that were going into private equity are being put into the index, right? So I think that is distorted.
Yeah, I think the counter-cyclical, the comments made earlier about bad times being good times for private equity, that's a discussion of deployment. It doesn't mean that your NAV growth during that period is going to look better. It just means that it's a good time to actually do new deals, and 5 years down the road, you'll be a benefit.
Okay.
Is that
interesting?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll move through this pretty briefly. On the first slide, it's sort of a year in review. You're all familiar with the deals that we've approved. I think the important thing to highlight is, there were only two new relationships that were added. Obviously, the bar on adding new relationships to this portfolio is very high. I think we have very high conviction behind both of those, and I think we'll continue to opportunistically think about what new relationships might be additive as we go forward. Each of them solved a particular problem. Not a problem, but a hole in the portfolio that we were looking to solve for. On slide 2, as of 9/30 last year, the allocation to private equity was at 20.9%. We had previously been managing toward a 20% target that got revised downward to 17.5% this year, or last year. So we were on, I think, an appropriate trajectory going into last year. And you'll see the pacing plan that has us on the glide path to get to the new target going forward. Importantly, it's a large portfolio today. Mike will talk more about this, but you have 230 active partnerships. It's a this is a battleship that you try and turn in the harbor every once in a while when you can. But it is large from an administrative perspective. Keith sort of touched on the performance on slide 3. I think, what we've seen is general underperformance post-financial crisis relative to public markets, relative to the industry benchmark provided by Cambridge. There's marginal outperformance over that period of time. Longer-term performance has held up and has been, sustained itself in an attractive and compelling way. Slide 4 is a different way that we look at it on a vintage year basis. We're aggregating vintage years of the portfolio, comparing it to an index and breaking out quartile rankings. You can see how that looks over time. Again, point to some of the lower, the weaker performing vintages. It's sort of that 2006, 2007, 2008 period that continues to be a drag on the portfolio. I'll skip over 5 because we talked about it briefly and just hit 6. This portfolio is now in a very strong net cash flow generating position. And we believe, based on sort of the model going forward, that should sustain itself for the foreseeable future, absent external shocks to the market. we will approach another potential record year last year once all the numbers are tied out on the distribution side and that sort of net cash flow number. And it looks very healthy going forward from that perspective based on how we're modeling out deployment in the future. On slide 7, we talk about just the underlying construction of portfolio by strategy. There have been no material changes, I think, from a strategy perspective based on the planning session that we had in December and how we're thinking about the underlying structure of the portfolio. We had previously talked to you all about, you know, about the lack of a focus on mezzanine fund of funds, for example, and none of that has really changed. We did identify growth last year as an area we were trying to add in. The General Atlantic relationship really was a way to solve for that. We got through the system last year. I think the only change that we really talked about was trying to take advantage of some of the distress that we view coming in the next 12 to 18 months and tweaking the portfolio potentially by upsizing certain relationships as we go through the deployment this year to take advantage of that. And then if you flip the page to slide 8 where we break it out by geography, I think we have identified the European market as an area that's sort of been sort of unwound itself over the last several years and isn't an area where we are looking to add some additional exposure given the relative stability that's held up, I think, compared to what people thought was going to happen in that market and some attractive pricing differentials between what was going to go on in the U.S. And there are some very strong partners in the portfolio that focus on Europe that are coming through the market this year. So that's a preview of coming attractions, I think, based on how we're looking at the forward calendar for the year. From an underlying portfolio company exposure perspective, it's a very well-diversified portfolio. I think, you know, consumer discretionary is the largest category from an industry perspective. I think that's true of almost any private equity portfolio. And in anybody's plan, that tends to be the largest category. You will benefit, I think, from you're effectively underweight energy, and you will, in the private equity portfolio, you're going to get some benefit from that as in this part of the cycle. You've also made some commitments in the last 2 years that are going to be able to be deployed really at the trough this year and next year that I think should generate some pretty attractive relative returns going forward. You know, we didn't necessarily predict that and time it. It's just the way that the cycle has played out, and you will generate some benefit from that. On slide 10, the highlight here is really, you know, the three green bars in 2006, 2007, 2008. You know, you've got almost 50% of the current fair market values in those three vintage years. And those are challenged, I would say, as a general categorization in terms of their performance. Some of the large underlevered deals that people are still trying to work out and come up with value creation solutions. And, you know, the path to exit is not always clear at this point either. So those are really sort of TBD in terms of the timing of the workouts there. Slide 11 is really just sort of the core relationships in the portfolio today. And I would sort of highlight the fact that we are trying to right-size what this graph looks like so that it's a little bit flatter and not so much of a distribution. Mike had mentioned, you know, normalizing commitment sizes and trying to bring up certain relationships that had been underexposed to in the past, and doing that within the context of you know, high conviction underwriting as well as the overall relationship budget framework that we're trying to use as we think about the portfolio. Slide 12 just shows you the 10 largest underlying portfolio companies. I'll skip through that. And then we've got just a few more sort of performance-related metrics. Slide 13 shows you the total value paid in capital multiple analysis of the portfolio. You know, you want to see a distribution out to the right. And, you know, we effectively see that here. I would say this looks okay from our perspective, and we want to see you know, more green on the right side over time, and it should continue to move that direction. And then slide 14, we do some high-level quartile rankings where you can see sort of in, we don't do quartiles for the most three recent vintage years because we view them to not be meaningful. So everything goes through 2012. And you can see in both cases, actually, inception to 2012 and for a 10-year window from 2002 to 2012, 61% of the funds by fund count are first or second quartile, and the percentages are pretty consistent across both time periods.
So how does this relate to page 4, where I was wondering if we'd already...
They're different quartile, they're different analytical frameworks. So
when I look at here, I wonder if we're already only getting second tier funds. But then, so it's confusing for me.
So on slide 14, we are looking at the, based on the number, it's a fund count calculation. So number of funds in each quartile. And it's done against the total universe of private equity, so the Cambridge all private equity benchmark. And it's a so the inception in 2012 is capturing a much longer period of time, obviously, than is represented on slide 4. That's a little bit more.
Well, on slide 4, our actual returns were second tier for the last lots of years.
A second quartile, but and that's somewhat distorted by capital, right? So you might have a. This is strictly by number of funds, not by capital allocation. And where slide 4 is a function of capital allocation and the number of funds.
I need you to plain English that for me, because this slide...
Okay, you could have a $10 million fund commitment that is first quartile, and then you could have a $500 million commitment that's fourth quartile. And the dollar amounts will distort their absolute...
Slide 4 is capital-weighted.
Right.
Slide 14 is not.
Well, that's real deal.
Yeah, that's what I understood. Okay, yeah. So let's talk about what this means. So the IRR quartile and the TBM quartile since 2005 or so, we're in the second and third quartile.
So what I would say is what this means to me is you're better at selecting funds than you are capital allocation. So you put big monies, a lot of big commitments into some funds that were, and specifically, I would say, in vintage years 2005, 2006, we put some big commitments into funds that weren't first quartile.
And I think there's, so I don't want to be, this is not
no money, Monday morning
defensive at all. I think that there's a fundamental reality that the quartile rankings capture the whole universe to the extent they can. I mean, there are big differences between one data set and the other. But the goal is to capture all the funds and say the top 25% are above this line. We are operating in a world where, if you think about all the GPs in the world, only about 20% of them raise funds that are of a size that is accessible to us. Now, what I'm not saying is that there's not top quartile managers in the top 20. What I'm saying is we start narrow down to 20% of the universe. So, point taken, we would love to be 75% top quartile. Believe me, I would love to sit here and tell you that's where we're at. I think realistically, we won't be able to push it that high. We'll certainly try and push it further in the top quartile than we have been.
You know what would be an interesting thing for us to learn is, especially out of our big commitments, where our managers lined up here so that we can understand who cut it and who didn't over the last, was it 8-9 years that we're second, third quartile? So that I think that would be helpful.
Well, you've thrown the gauntlet at us to get our crap together about what our policy initiatives are. So we're throwing it right to you.
Yeah.
It's a virtuous circle. Boom.
We went through line by line now.
Yeah, but we do have that detail.
That would be great. I would love to see cover. That.
I think that what we'll find out, because we've looked at that exercise, is the universe of your addressable universe is constrained. It's not the entire market, as Michael suggested, because you're trying to fit in sizable amounts. And so the small end of the marketplace is simply not accessible to you. These are sub $500 million.
But it would be a good exercise for us to do, because the reality is maybe we shouldn't be in these funds. Maybe we need to fight harder to get the proper staffing so that we can dip down, so that we can get the returns back up to top tier. I mean, we need that piece of information.
So the challenge there, and I would say the challenge there is your portfolio will be much bigger. And we've been trying to go the other direction. But the other piece of it is relative to plans of your size, that all the CME studies that I've ever seen that you've all commissioned the third party to do put you guys consistently in the top one to three players of funds your size, of programs your size.
Yeah,
so relative to your pension
we
units.
Don't want
to
be, we don't want to be good for mediocre.
No, no, no.
Best for mediocre.
No, no. But relative, on an apples-to-apples basis, you guys are the best at this relative to your peer group.
Yeah, so we want to pass them on the uphill.
Yeah.
Well,
there is a part of this equation that, you know, we're all privy to in terms of the planning, the sort of underwriting exercise. You see sort of what comes out of the sausage factory. There's a lot of stuff on the floor, and that those piles have been getting bigger and bigger every year as we address some of these issues and think about what makes sense on a go-forward basis and think about, you know, underwriting criteria and how to apply things like persistence and performance versus what the market looks like on a go-forward basis. So there's, you know, there's a lot around this whole issue.
I just think we want to see some of that stuff that's still on the floor.
Okay. And if in the end, Mike, in support of whatever your vision is, that we need to find resources or rethink infrastructure, then that's what we need to do. Right?
So. Well, maybe just to illustrate a little bit some of the process we've been going over the last couple of months. We'll come to the specifics of the plan, but in preparation for what will be a couple years of hard work to figure out where to put the capital, we did what I think is a reasonably exhaustive market mapping exercise last fall. So internally staffed, we took the full universe of, call it 9,000, 10,000 general partners, narrowed that down to 1,000 scale in our market map, which we'll track over time. Those are funds that raised at least $500 million in their last fund. Really, most of them are closer to $1 billion because that's the size of funds that can really start to play. From there, we independently, on a unconstrained basis, unconstrained by portfolio construction or by existing relationships, the three of us independently went away and came up with our 60 favorite GPs. And then we had a discussion about how would you all put this together and who is really worthy of consideration over the next several years. We took the output of that, which was probably, you wouldn't be surprised to know that we have good GPs, so it was a decent crossover from those lists and all this. But we ended up with, call it 120 names. We brought that to the offsite at Torrey Cove on a line-by-line basis. We sat around the table and talked about every name and overlaid that with projected fundraising timelines. And the goal was, and certainly not meant to be overly prescriptive, we want to be flexible, but we have what we think is a reasonable map of where we're going to spend our time. And if we sort of, the plan really calls for doing 10 to 15 commitments a year to keep the roster manageable from a GP standpoint. So if you think about that 1,000 GP addressable universe, 250 plus or minus will raise money every year. So 10, 12, 15 of 250. We're being very selective. We are putting a lot on the floor, so to speak, to use that analogy. So we're moving in this direction, certainly trying to put a little bit more framework around it. But we can give you as much transparency on the line by line as you'd like.
Okay, so
I'm
sorry,
did I need
reality
No, that's a great segue into maybe flip to page 17, right? Which is the pacing outlook. You know, we're now reflecting the new target allocation is 17.5% relative to 40% last year. And I think, you know, the model doesn't look all that different from what we actually presented last year. I think we had sort of prescribed a glide path that was going to get below that 20% target. And we were generally talking about sort of $3 billion a year for the next couple of years. You know, I think we've changed a little bit how we're talking about this now to sort of indicate this notion of flexibility and not trying to manage to a number, because that's really not, I think, a prudent way to go about this, but trying to, we've identified the universe, we have sort of a broad, we've set some goalposts on what we think in any given year is a reasonable range of commitments, that if we're within those goalposts over time, with some volatility to the upside and downside, that should generally support management to the target. And we're trying to match that up against the opportunity set that we see, the level of conviction related to those relationships, and accommodate unusual circumstances that might arise that would, you know, require us to have some flexibility in terms of what we're doing. So the way we've set this out is, you know, basically over a five-year period, we're managing generally down to that 17.5% target. And assuming that we will commit between $2.5 and $3.5 billion a year for the next several years. Some might be under, some might be over, but on average, you know, that's sort of how we get to that target.
So the way I read it is, it looks like you're managing to lower, it looks like you're managing to 15, if I'm looking at the green line. Is that not?
Well, I think we are presenting a conservative plan at this point that, you know, gets us to the target within sort of a five-year period. But, you know, what you do in the out years in this scenario is going to sort of dictate how steep that decline continues to be, or, you know, if it flattens out, or even if it might go back up.
I mean, I would focus on where you end up in 2019, which is the crossover point. That's the time frame I think we're really talking about for this range.
And obviously, this is directional. It's not meant to be precise, right? I wish we had the ability to predict 5 years out with greater precision.
Yeah, I think it has proven to be reasonably accurate on a short-term basis, and I think, you know, we are comfortable with the assumptions.
So I think there's a couple other things we wanted to highlight on the go-forward plan. So if I alluded to the process we've gone through recently to think about how you would actually put this amount of money to work, and the constraints we're using, as I already said, we're trying to, we've made a ton of progress the last several years managing down our universe of active GP relationships. So a huge amount of progress has already been made on that front. The next wave of that journey, as we've alluded to a couple times, is tightening the band of commitment. So we'll try to continue to operate with this informal cap of $500 million for commitments, while at the same time migrating the smaller commitments up towards $100 million and hopefully $150 million. The outlier there is venture. We continue to just be opportunistic with respect to venture. I mean, it's a small part of what we do. We cannot force an allocation there of any catastrophic load. So we'll leave that aside, but for the growth and buyout managers, we'll try and operate in that band, which dictates, as I say, about 10 to 15 commitments per year. A couple other things I just wanted to touch on in summary. One of the next most important initiatives, so that's sort of the implementation piece, would be we are in the process of enhancing our monitoring and due diligence processes. Started last year and we'll implement a lot more this year. I mean, obviously, I'm talking about continuous improvement. You never start or stop trying to do your job better and more efficiently. But I highlight it now because it was a very clearly articulated 2016 deliverable from management and from the OIC. So I just wanted to note that we've taken on that feedback and we're taking it seriously. The last piece is another project we'd like to undertake if we can get the time. And it really pertains to the monitoring and management of our mature portfolio. As we've said a couple times, the industry as a whole is dealing with a glut of current exposure in the pre-crisis vintages. And our portfolio might be an extreme example of that. think about 25% of our live funds are past the generally used 10-year conceived life. So they're in extensions or in dissolution. And something like 60% of our funds are pre-crisis, so seven, eight plus years old. I highlight this because we have a lot of funds that continue to hold a lot of portfolio companies as they reach that 10-year milestone, and we'll see a new cohort each of the next 3 years hit that milestone. And it's presenting a number, for everyone, not just us, a number of issues because these funds are not in a position to pursue a normal liquidation or dissolution. So increasingly, the GPs are turning to liquidity options or structuring options and things of that nature. These things can be incredibly time-consuming from a monitoring standpoint. The proposals that are coming out are very complex, and if you don't give them the time and attention they need, some of them are pretty questionable proposals from the GPs. So to optimize the realization of that tail end value, we're having to allocate an increasing amount of time. As I said, it gets more acute each of the next couple of years. So that's a long way of saying we would like to study over the course of the year whether there is a solution to help us with this problem. And if solution sounds like an open-ended statement, that's probably purposeful. I think, you know, it could mean selling assets on the secondary market. It could mean engaging a third party on an advisory basis to help us monitor assets in place, a combination of those two. It could mean that we have to suck it up and spend more time on this part of the portfolio. Any of those things could be the outcome, but I highlight it because it's a problem we're dealing with, and we would like to be in a position to hopefully have a conversation later this year about how we solve the problem. So that was sort of the last piece I wanted to introduce. And I don't know if you guys had any summary comments, but happy to take further questions.
So translating that into magnitude, and this is a rough hack, if we have 20 million or so out of private equity in a quarter, there may be in workouts. Is it fair to say that something like $5 billion worth of assets are in a place where we have to figure out?
No, I don't think it's that high. So we probably have $7 or $8 billion of assets that are in the 7-plus year old. But the real problems show up 10, 11, 12, 13 years. That's a much smaller, from a capital allocation standpoint, that's a much smaller amount of capital, probably less than 15% of the portfolio.
It's a lot of relationships, very small portion of fair market value.
It's the fund count issue we deal with. I mean, we could solve the overallocation issue very easily with a couple of large funds. It's these smaller universe of funds, very late in life, where the GPs have, frankly, no prospects.
So the prospect is $2 billion worth of assets taking up 80% of your...
Yeah, that's
once they start, it takes up a lot of time.
So if you're, usually these are managers that have maybe two or four holdings left, and for whatever reasons don't necessarily want to sell them. They're trying to reinvent themselves and creating fairly complicated circuitous proposals in many cases that involve a lot of cycling of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Hershey.
I'm not even sure I need to sit down. So this is the annual private placement contingent disclosure segment of the day. What's notable here for me is simply that last year was, I think the number was 10 in 2015. I think that was in 2014, 2015, there's only two. So let's see what happens. Any questions?
Is there a decrease in the use of placement agents, or is it just the funds we're using?
Number of it, we have a lot of re-ups, so we do a lot of re-ups, and then managers don't tend to help you use placement agents. We have more mature managers and re-ups, and so they oftentimes they don't have in-house marketing people. So you tend to see placement agents maybe more on the venture side, where they don't have the staff size to... warrant having a full-time marketing person for fundraising or something.
Sure.
First, apologies to the council and the audience for thinking the agenda was skinny enough to forego a break. Second, agenda item number 5 is the proposed schedule for 2017. Last quarter, we had a challenge getting everybody on board for all the 2016 dates, so that was just a signal to me to get out in front of this earlier. So hopefully this is a schedule that in 2017 we'll get full attendance, or at least give people plenty of lead time to plan around.
Really appreciate it.
Stay on point.
Do we not need a motion to adopt this?
Oh.
I don't know what we do. Well, if you're going to adopt, I'm doing a motion. Because it's simply advisory. You don't.
So it depends what you want to do with it.
You want to have the damn part?
I'd like to, yeah. Okay. Agenda item number 6, asset allocation and NAVs. Nothing noteworthy other than to continue to remind everybody that the one asset class that appears out of balance is the alternatives program, which is in a build mode. And Ben Mahon, who is the senior investment officer of our program, is out on paternity leave, but when he returns, he and Mike Mueller have a lot of work to do. So that's the area of real growth in the portfolio going forward. Agenda item number 7 is the calendar for 2016 and the proposed agenda items for the next series of meetings. Nothing particularly noteworthy there, although we're looking for things to do in August. Yeah. And then agenda item number 8 is other business. And I have a couple of things that I wanted to talk about under that header, but maybe there are council comments too.
Our next meeting is a real estate discussion, and I want to plant a seed for that. I'm concerned that to some degree we may be constrained by our compensation system, where the expectation is that real estate will be sold on a 3, 5, 7 year basis. And I'm not sure, obviously our managers, that's a good thing for our managers because that's how they get paid. They get paid by the period. But in doing so, I think there's a high correlation to the markets. And, I look at my own buildings where I've held them for a long period of time. In the middle of the downturn, they were worth a fraction of what they were prior to that, but I didn't care because I was in it for the dividend. But if you buy real estate for its dividend, it's almost completely uncorrelated to the market. And I look at my own college, which hasn't ever charged tuition in 125 years because it was funded by a portion of the southeast tip of Manhattan. Cooper Union never charged tuition in 125 years. They own the Chrysler Building. They've had that since Peter Cooper donated the land for it. And I think we ought to take a look at making sure that our interests and aren't at odds with the compensation system that we've set up for what are called value-added investing.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Is John Sherbel.
Yes.
Exactly.
So I have 2 items. First, I want to formally introduce Carl Hausserfuss, who is our new general counsel and chief compliance and risk officer. So I alluded to Carl's hiring last meeting, but he has now come aboard.
Welcome.
And then the second thing is I wanted to provide the council with a brief summary of the remarks that I gave at the PERS board meeting on Friday. Director Rodeman asked me to make some remarks, and I thought it would be worthwhile to share those with the council as well.
And I want to, in these remarks or in this summary, I just want to talk about the macro environment, and then I want to talk about our portfolio. And so, again, Director Rogan asked me to address PERS, and it was last week, and I was down in San Francisco at the Callan College, Callan Annual Conference, and I was thinking, boy, what am I going to talk about? And then Jim Callahan started off their conference with a presentation that included this slide. And, you know, it was a bolt of lightning out of the sky for me. I said, that's perfect for the remarks I want to make, because it really sets the stage or provides excellent context for where we've been and where we are. And these are the capital market expectations that Callan used January 1, 1995, January 1, 2005, January 1, 2015. These are not the returns that were realized, but this was the great minds at Callan waking up on January 1st in each of those years, looking out into the world and saying, what do we expect to happen? What are our ex-ante forecasts? And again, I think this is very useful to understand where we've been, where we are, and put a point on really what is a conundrum for us, because 20 years ago, we could meet our expected return, our assumed return expectations with a portfolio that was comprised 100% of fixed income. Fast forward 10 years, the world gets a little more challenging, and you had to inject risk assets into that portfolio, but you could still have half your portfolio in fixed income and meet your 7.5% return expectation. Fast forward another 10 years, the world gets even more challenging, and that fixed income allocation is much smaller, and you would have had to inject a much greater proportion and variety of risk assets. And of course, when you look at that pie chart on the far right, it isn't exactly what OPERF is, but it's pretty darn close. We are there. And so the message is, there is not a higher gear to go to. We're already there. And as we will increasingly learn throughout the year, the fact that we haven't met the assumed earnings rate over the past couple of years has material consequences to the funded ratio. But for those of us on the asset side, there isn't another gear to go to. So this is now, in my opinion, very much an environmental macroeconomic issue. But as I was sitting there listening to Jim Callahan, I thought, let's run the experiment the other way. Again, maybe just at the risk of piling on. What if the charge had been not to meet a particular return target, but in fact to meet a particular risk target? And so this is the same exercise, but holding risk constant. And the consequence of holding risk constant over the years, no surprise, you have to give up return. So we're not in a position with an assumed earnings rate of 7.5%, we're not in a position where we can hold risk constant. We have to accept more risk to generate additional return to have a realistic chance of hitting 7.5%.
Great slide.
Great
and terrifying
sense. So, for me, sitting in the audience listening to Jim Callahan, I thought this was terrific context to frame up the environment in which we operate. And then the last point I want to make, going from the broader environment to our fund, is we're in good shape. We're in good shape in relative terms. The fund, and this is a preview of coming attractions, Janet will talk about our performance, our Q4 2015 performance in greater detail at our next OIC meeting. But the punchline is 2.1%, far short of the assumed earnings rate, but on a peer group relative basis, very good, top quartile. This is Callan's universe, and I'm certain we'll come in at the top quartile in the Tux universe as well. So relative performance, very good. Portfolio in good shape in a challenging environment. And then the last thing I want to talk about and perhaps solicit questions on is we're in good shape, but we're also at least 2 years into a journey together where we're making the portfolio more resilient. And so that's important to recognize in the context of a challenging year in 2015 and a very difficult start to 2016. Well, just in the first month, we're down 5%, 6% on equity markets in 1 month. But I thought it was important to remind everybody that, and I'm going to channel my inner Marine, we've prepared for this, we've trained for this. We're not all the way there, but we started a process together 2 years ago to deliberately evaluate every element of the portfolio with an eye towards making it more resilient so that we emerge with a portfolio that is more buoyant in rough seas, just like we've experienced in the last month. And just to recap what we've done, we started 2 years ago, we started with the public equity portfolio. And in the public equity portfolio, we started moving from traditional active strategies to more systematic strategies that were more dependable. That year, we also started reconstituting the fixed income portfolio. We lowered its embedded equity risk by lowering the credit. We improved the quality. The next year, and Mike has already alluded to this, the private equity team started rationalizing their efforts, putting more wood behind fewer arrows, more wood behind fewer better arrows. And then this past year, working with our consultants, we significantly expanded the alternatives portfolio with the express objective of looking for sources of returns that could continue to move the portfolio forward, but were less correlated, ideally non-correlated, with equity markets. And again, there's a lot more work to do, but that is central in the objective of making the portfolio more buoyant in rough seas. And then lastly, and Mr. Russell has given us a terrific segue, the last part of the portfolio to undergo this transformation is real estate. And so Tony talked about that last month at the OIC meeting, and he's going to come back either in March or April with detailed plans about how we move the real estate part of the portfolio to a different role in which it is more defensive and provides true diversification relative to the equity risk embedded in the other parts. So I guess in summary, portfolio is in good shape, but it is also at the limit, in my opinion, of what it can do, and that we're well on our way to creating a portfolio that is not only a good performing portfolio, but is one that is more resilient, given that, by necessity, it has to be very growth-biased relative to the assumed earnings rate.
So could I chime in on this? First of all, thank you for this presentation. I think it exactly illustrates a key point. And I get asked probably twice a day about PERS and the resilience of PERS and where is the PERS portfolio. And I keep pointing out to people, just as you have, that the game is really on the asset side of the equation. And that's been underscored here in January. We had, I believe, it finishes the worst January in history. Capital markets are in chaos. And what I really want to applaud my colleagues here and you, John, and the investment team and our consultants on is, we're not being reactive. We have a plan in place. We've changed our strategy exactly four times like these, and we're executing on that plan, and we're continuing to execute. So if there's one message I can leave people with, we're not just passengers in terms of what's happening in capital markets. We're on it. And I'm really proud of the work we've done to put that plan together and to be thoughtful about how we're going to approach times like these. So
I just want to underscore everything you're doing and say how much I'm appreciative of the work you've done over the last couple of years to get us here.
Philosophical question, if I may?
Sure.
We're always looking at value as a measure, but I'm not sure that's only one of the measurements. Cash flow is the other. And so, for example, you buy a 30-year treasury bond. Its value may fluctuate enormously over the period of time, but if you're buying it for its yield, that's a constant. So if you're buying it for the cash flow, you've gotten it. But if you every month or year you evaluate it on the basis of value, you might assume that you made a bad decision. What would our return look like if we were looking at it in terms of cash flow?
So we are, as a system, negative cash flow. Negative cash flow to the tune of about $230 million a month. And that over time will get worse, which is why we don't have the luxury of building a truly defensive portfolio. We have to continue to play offense in the form of a growth tilt because the cash flow of the system is negative and going more negative. And that was part of what I was trying to accomplish with this slide is somebody might come to Ted and say, well, come on, you knuckleheads, it's challenging markets out there, why don't you get more defensive? With a 7.5% earnings target that drives the solvency of the system, given the promises that have been made, we don't have the luxury. But there are things that we can do to modify, and this repositioning of the real estate portfolio is perhaps the best example. To going from exposure to real estate in the form of capital appreciation to a greater emphasis on, you mentioned dividend, I'll say clipping a coupon or collecting rent, something that's more durable. And it's just changing the composition of total return. Total return is capital appreciation plus dividends, and we're simply changing the composition to be less capital appreciation and more dividends. So that the real growth forces in the portfolio, public equity and private equity, can continue to run.
So John, I try to do it a couple times a year, but I'd sit down with Steve next year and have him continue to give you a primer. We're going to meet at least once, maybe twice this year with the first board jointly, because I think it's super important to me. Personally, I think this is the single largest issue our state's dealing with, and I don't think that our elected officials, this one aside, are paying enough attention to it. So we need to do what we can, and we need to understand what they're dealing with. So.
I understand. There's no simple answer. But I do think evaluating our portfolio in terms of cash flow is something we're not doing that I think might be instructive.
Again, this is the point of these slides, is how challenging it is. If you had a time machine and we could just all jump in and go back 20 years, we'd immunize the portfolio in fixed income. But today, the 10-year treasury is trading at 1.8.
I know.
And so
I know well, John.
We don't have the luxury of getting defensive and meeting our obligations through income and dividends alone. We don't have that luxury. We are, by necessity, risk takers, even though at the same time we are returns takers, in the sense that we don't control the macro environment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Reveal 1,898 trips over the past 4 years.
In 2015, Leonard Green's jets made at least 423 flights. Travel includes flights to and from locations such as Palm Beach, Florida, 19 flights, Aspen, Colorado, 18 flights, Cabo San Lucas, 14 flights, London, 10 flights, as well as Turkey, Italy, France, Korea, and Japan. Nearly 300 flights were to or from locations where Leonard Green principal's own residential properties in New York, Idaho, and California. I've shared with you a report and a hard copy of the AA data from 4 years organized by aircraft tail number. One example is a trip from Thanksgiving of 2015. The aircraft tail number N850LG spent 9 days in the Reno, Tahoe area in California from November 21st through November 29th. In July 2015, N950LG was in Colombia for 7 days, landing in Bogota on July 6th and flying out on July 12th from Cartagena back to Westchester, New York. For Valentine's Day weekend, which is coming up this year soon, N750LG flew to Iztapa y Montaneco in Mexico. Over the course of March and April of 2014, the jets took separate trips to Los Cabos, Mexico, twice, the Bahamas, the U.S. Virgin Islands, St. Martin, and Hawaii, twice. Oregon may be considering committing to Leonard Green's newest fund, Green Equity Investors 7. The OIC may want more transparency on how the firm expenses jet travel. As you know, the SEC Office of Compliance Inspection and Examination, state treasurers, and organizations such as the Institutional Limited Partners Association have highlighted the need for greater disclosure of fee and expense practices by private equity firms. We suggest LPs consider the following questions. How does Leonard Green disclose whether private jet travel is expense to Green Equity Investors funds, and thus borne by limited partners, expense to portfolio companies, and thus ultimately borne by limited partners, covered directly by limited partners, paid for by the firm itself, and or Leonard Green staff? How does Leonard Green handle expenses for its jets if they are utilized for personal use, such as vacations? Who ultimately pays the bill when Leonard Green utilizes its jets to market a new buyout fund, such as Green Equity?